Please turn in your Bibles to the 8th chapter of the book of Daniel. Daniel 8. Also, in your packet of charts, turn it to the one that says the Grecian Empires. That'll be almost halfway through the chart package, but it'll be this one right here. If you have that in front of you, that'll be helpful. And I'll also have one up on the overhead. If you do not have a book for this class, some more have been printed, and I think they're available in the back. You can have someone pick you up one right now, or you can pick one up on the way out. And we still have the chart packages too. So I think we're caught up. If we're not, let me know after class, and we'll print some more. It's good to see all of you. We're talking about the period between the Testaments, and we've got down last time to the empire of Alexander the Great. He's one of history's great significant characters because he changes warfare, he changes culture throughout the Middle East and beyond. He creates what's called the Oikumene, and it is basically, as it was described by the Greeks, the whole known world. Now, there was world outside of the Greek world, but he expands the Greek world from just beyond the peninsula that we think of as Greece, and the Greek cities on the western part of what's now Turkey, to the whole area of the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean. So Greek language, Greek culture, Greek thought is something that expands because of this in a way that was far beyond what had been done by the Babylonians or the Persians. You remember we talked about Daniel 2 being the outline for the period between the Testaments, because as Daniel revealed to Nebuchadnezzar in the great statue that he saw, he was Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. The chest of silver was the Medes and the Persians. But the third kingdom is what we're talking about right now, and that's the kingdom of with the thighs of bronze, and that basically is started by Alexander the Great. I need a reader this evening to read for me Daniel 8, verses 5 through 8. We read that last time, but I think it's important to revisit it. I've had some macular degeneration problems lately, and I went to the dentist. That's part of my problem. I go to the dentist for eye problems. I went to the optometrist today, a retinal specialist, and they've messed with my eyes, so I can't see you very well. If you guys with the mics will point out somebody, I'd appreciate it. Thanks, Cassidy. Thanks, Jim.
Daniel 8, verses 5 through 8. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and he ran at him with a furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him. He attacked the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven.
Okay, thank you. We see in this particular vision that Daniel sees, a situation in which the Medes and the Persians, their empire, is described as the empire of the ram. What, two horns, one more conspicuous than the other. But then from the west comes a male goat with a long horn, and he comes without touching the ground. There's such speed with his conquest. And he is able to trample the ram, which is the Medes and the Persians, with the empire he establishes. But about the time that he does that, his horn is broken, and it's replaced by four conspicuous horns. That's what we're going to be talking about tonight. You remember we were talking about Alexander's conquests last time, and we got up to the point of the conquest of Tyre. You remember he had defeated Darius III, the Persian emperor, at Issus, up close to Antioch. And at that particular place, he had even captured the baggage train and the family of Darius III, including his mother, who was very displeased with Darius III for retreating and leaving her and his wife and his children there. He offers 10,000 talents to Alexander to release them, and also says, I'll give you the area that you've already conquered. You can be called King of Asia, which is in that purpose. It means just Asia Minor. You'll notice on your map, it's hard for me to get around this thing to point to it, but Asia Minor, where Ephesus and other cities are, is the area that he basically surrenders to him. Alexander says, you know, I'll treat your family with respect. I'll surrender them to you. But since I'm already king of Asia, I'm not going to accept any terms that you have established. And so Darius retreats. Alexander continues his conquest toward the south, down along the area of Israel and Canaan. So you may notice on your map, as you go, it's toward the center of the map, slightly to the left. There you see Canaan and the city of Tyre. When we were talking about the city of Tyre last time, you remember what Alexander had done, consistently with what we see being described in Ezekiel 26. That's exactly what happened. Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Tyre, but the complete conquest of Tyre takes place under Alexander, where the Tyrians go to the island that is the port. They say, Alexander, you can't take us. You don't have a big enough navy to be able to conquer us. Alexander is not going to be dissuaded, so he basically recruits the population of Tyre to destroy the city and move the rubble out into the sea to such an extent that he creates a causeway to Tyre, and he captures the city and destroys it. In fact, when he takes this city, he has all the men of military age killed and has all the women and children sold into slavery. So Alexander was a interesting fella. There's times when he really shows benevolence, but there's times when he shows great, great cruelty as well. I wanted to be able to show you a good picture of what would be a likeness of him, because we have copies of a statue by Lysippus that he himself commissioned that's supposed to look a lot like him. But as most paintings and sculptures of great historical characters, they look an awful lot better than the person genuinely did. Alexander is described by Arian as having a very straight nose, having a slightly protruding lower jaw, full lips, his neck was perpetually toward the right with his head slightly turned. He was supposed to have had one blue eye and one brown eye. And his hair is described as xanthan, which is a peculiar color in Greece, but it is defined either as blonde or red or tawny. I've noticed this when I've gone over to preach in Italy. They'll talk about someone being blonde there. And I look around and I can't see any blondes. But in a culture where most people have black hair, slightly brown hair is called blonde. So we don't know exactly what color his hair was. It could have been Nordic blonde. It could have been red-headed. But those colors were kind of like, you know, when somebody describes a horse's coat, sometimes it has a different color than what we think about it. Or somebody talks about a yellow dog's not yellow, a yellow dog is tan. You know, they'll use those colors with horses like bay and dun and chestnut and sorrel. Xanthan is one of those kinds of words. And so we do get the idea that his hair was lighter than most Greeks. But Arian just basically describes him, and he wrote the campaigns of Alexander after Alexander's time and said he was very handsome. So I've said all that to give you very little information. But those are the things that have been said and written about Alexander and his appearance. After he conquers Tyre, he goes to Jerusalem and does not destroy it. One of the stories about it is that the high priest, Jaddua, was a fellow who told Alexander about Daniel's prophecies. And that impressed Alexander to such an extent that he basically, while capturing the city, doesn't destroy it or doesn't loot it, and goes on to Gaza. Now, Gaza stood up against him and is built on a hill. And he three times tried to conquer it by just storming the hill, but finally is able to conquer it. And when he conquers it, he kills all the men, sells all the women and children, just like he had done up at Tyre. Then he goes to Egypt. And Egypt, as you'll notice, is on the south west portion of your map. And in Egypt, he found a great time. He spent several months in Egypt. And the Egyptians are glad to see him. They think of him as a liberator over the Persians. And they are people who are not as strange. It's not as strange for them to have a foreign ruler. So they praise him. They'll call him one of the pharaohs. He goes to the oasis at Siwa to the oracle of Amun-Ra. And there the prophet says that he is descended from Amun-Ra. And Alexander hears this and he thinks, great, I'm descended from a god. And he assumed Ra was the same god as Zeus. So sometimes on the inscriptions about him, he'll call himself Zeus Amun. And he's praised by the Egyptians. He builds a city there. And you can tell Alexander is very humble because he names the city Alexandria. Who do you think it was named after? And it becomes the most important city in Egypt and, again, the center of Greek culture. Also, within the period of time we're going to be talking about this quarter, It becomes the center of Jewish culture in Egypt. In fact, by the time of Christ, you remember when he is fleeing from Herod, where he goes? Probably to Alexandria, where there are lots of Jews. And like I say, it may very well have had more Jews than Jerusalem had at the period between the Testaments. The time in Egypt is just wonderful. His soldiers get some rest and recreation there. They enjoy it. There are a lot of building projects that are made. He builds temples to the Greek gods there in Egypt too. And again, has himself declared Pharaoh, as the people are willing to concede to that. After several months there, he goes to Mesopotamia, which is in the center part of your map. Mesopotamia just means between the rivers, and it is between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, again, in the center of your map. And there is where Darius is, Darius III, and he fights against him in a battle that culminates at Gaugamela. Let me see if it's on your map here. It is not, but it is just right. If you could put a dot in the middle of the map up there, it would be Gaugamela, where the culminating battle with Darius is fought. Gaugamela means camel's house. And in there in the desert, he fights the Persians and defeats them basically in a battle that destroys Persian power. Darius III retreats to Arbela, which is very close there. So sometimes in what you're reading, it will call this battle the Battle of Arbela. And Alexander then moves to Babylon. One of the things, though, when he writes to Babylon trying to get them to surrender, he describes himself as Alexander, ruler of the world, and sends instructions to Babylon telling them to surrender and that his forces won't loot any of their houses. So Babylon is treated with a great deal of respect, at least here initially, by Alexander the Great. He has in mind making Babylon kind of the center of his empire, and especially later on after his Indian campaign, he'll come back to Babylon with the idea of being able to make it a great capital. That's not what happens, though. In Isaiah, the 13th chapter, for example, turn to Isaiah 13, beginning in verse 20. Can I get another reader for that, please, to read verses 20 through 22? This is talking about Babylon, which, although the Babylonian Empire had fallen, it was still a significant city in Alexander's time, okay?
It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherds will make their flocks lie down there. But wild animals will lie down there, and their houses will be full of howling creatures. There ostriches will dwell, and there wild goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers, and jackals in the pleasant palaces. Its time is close at hand, and its days will not be prolonged.
In spite of what Alexander has in mind, Babylon's not going to become his capital. Babylon's going to become a ruin. And I've never been to Iraq, where the site of Babylon is, but some of you gentlemen may have been in one of the wars we fought over there, and Babylon is just a ruin today. And that's amazing. Can you imagine New York City becoming a ruin that the owls and the ostriches live in? It's hard to imagine. That's Babylon, at that particular time, was probably the most populous city in the world. And here the Lord says it's going to become nothing in spite of the things that Alexander has in mind. He continues his campaign to the east and fights Darius, but Darius retreats to such an extent that he's finally betrayed by a Bactrian satrap whose name is Bessus. And Bessus is able to think that, as he declares himself, Artaxerxes V, that he'll be the successor to Darius III. Alexander doesn't like this, and when he finally gets the body of Darius III, he gives it great royal honors in its burial, and he goes and fights against Bessus and is able to destroy him and kill him. He then moves into India, which is on the very far eastern part of the orange of your map there. And he goes into the upper reaches of the Indus River, one of the great river civilizations of the world. And at the great battle of Hydaspes, he fights against the Indians and defeats them. He makes allies among some of the Indian princes that are up there to the north. And there we see him fighting with using elephants like the Indians do in fight. And he builds cities, many of them called Alexandria. One of them's called Bucephala, after his favorite horse named Bucephalus. Bucephalus in Greek means cow head. Which, you, if any of you have horses, you might consider naming them Bucephalus. But he names a city after his favorite horse. But also one of the great elephants that had shown itself, he thought, brave in one of the battles. He took it and had gold around its tusks, had it decorated and everything, had temples built to it, and shows himself to be a real lover of that aspect of the culture. Yes.
I just got a question. Just, this has been something I've wondered. Did Hinduism, like, that's big in India. Mm-hmm. Is that prominent now during this time?
Yes.
Okay. So
it's about 1500 BC that the Hindus, that the Aryans invade the Indian subcontinent, and they bring Hinduism as it kind of overwhelms and unites with the culture that was already there. That help? Alexander, about this time, also is beginning to do some things that bother his Macedonian generals. He starts developing Eastern dress in the way he dresses. Up just before he moves into India, he has his generals, who don't much like that, all marry Persian or Bactrian women. And some of them don't like that. Most of those marriages don't last more than a year. But Alexander, he's real big on emphasizing his ideas and what is important to him. And he forces people to do things, many things that they would not do normally. In India, he has several wounds. He was hurt back at the Granicus River that we talked about last time with a shoulder wound. He gets another shoulder wound in the upper Indus River. In the lower Indus River, he has wounded in his ankle. And then he takes another shoulder wound as they retreat from there. But at the Hephaestus River, which is one of the five tributaries of the Indus in the Punjab, there his soldiers finally say, enough. And we're not talking about the conscripts. We're talking about his generals who have been with him for now, by this time, 11 years away from home. And they say, we need to see our parents, our wives, our children, because we've done what you want to do. The idea apparently was that Alexander wanted to go on into the Ganges River, and he'd heard about this place called China that he wanted to invade. But his men say, we don't want to be gone any longer. And even though he tries to persuade them otherwise, they won't be persuaded, and he finally consents to stopping there at the Hephaestus River. It's called the Bias River today, and I've seen it in India. And you get the idea if you've seen the movies or if you think anything, if you've read it, that it's not really much of a river. It's a significant river. It's probably as wide as the Mississippi at Memphis, but it's probably not as deep because it rises and falls according to the seasonal rain. But it's a substantial river. They built a bridge over one of the tributaries of the Indus. They don't want to do any more. And he finally agrees, and they go down the Indus River to the far southeastern portion of the orange area on our map, and begins to retreat toward Persepolis, Susa, and Babylon. Across that area, though, he winds up losing a lot of men. He's lost a lot over the course of time in battle. They've been replaced by Macedonians and Greeks who have come to meet him along the way. But here he loses probably half of his men in the desert that's in what today the southern part of Pakistan and the southern part of Iran, and finally makes it to Babylon, where he decides is going to be his capital, and he sets up and begins to build there. But something happens in Babylon that nobody expected. He gets ill, probably because of excessive drinking and the wounds that he's received in battle. He gets an illness that is hard to define. Some have said it was malaria. Some have said he was poisoned. But oddly enough, for the poisons of the time, it takes about 2 weeks to get him. And his health just declines. And on the night of the 10th and the 11th of June, 323, he dies. And that was something nobody was expecting. In fact, his generals really couldn't imagine a world that Alexander didn't rule. Before he dies, it becomes evident that he is in poor health. So he allows all of his commanders, probably everybody from captain down up, to be able to pass by his deathbed and say something to him. Arrian said, who's the writer who records his life, says he couldn't speak at this particular point, but there's all kinds of varying traditions. But I like the idea of all of those soldiers passing by him and saying goodbye to him before he dies. His generals are some of the most ambitious men in the world. And they decide that when they realize that he's going to die, we got to find somebody who's going to lead this bunch. His best friend, Hephaestion, has already died. He takes his ring and gives it to his new best friend, Perdiccas. They keep asking him, though, who do you want to take your place? And he says in Greek, toi kratistoi, which means to the strongest. Now, at the time, he has a child in utero by a Bactrian princess named Roxanne that he had married. It is also rumored that by Statira, who was the daughter of Darius III, he has another child that he's expecting. So probably what he has in mind is, whichever one of those babies that comes along is the strongest, I want him to take my place. Just so happens, though, he has a captain of the guard named Craterus. So Kratistoi and Craterus sound a little bit alike in Greek for a fellow who's sick. And so some people think he's going to be the one. Well, that's not necessarily pleasing to everybody. When he dies, again, he's got perhaps two babies in utero. He has a brother back in Macedon who is mentally challenged. And there are parties that develop around each one of those. But within the first 3 years, one of those babies is born but is killed as an infant. One of those babies' mother's killed before she's born, before the baby is born. And Perdiccas is killed within the first year. And what you have left is, like we talked about in Daniel 8, four conspicuous horns. Four of the most ambitious generals that you can imagine. Actually, it starts out with five, but they are interesting fellows. The two that are going to be the most important for us in between the Testament studies are Seleucus, who basically is going to be the one who assumes rule over Asia, except for Asia Minor. Ptolemy is another one, the son of Lagus. Although rumors were that he was Alexander's half-brother, but Lagus is described as his father instead of Philip. Lysimachus is one who rules in Thrace, in the northwest part of your map up here, and in Bithynia, which is just across into Asia Minor, around where Istanbul is today. And Cassander, who decides he'll just rule in Macedon and Greece. One of the most powerful ones at the time, though, is a guy whose name was Antigonus Monophthalmos. That mean anything to you? Monophthalmos? Mono, one, ophthalmos, eye. He's also called Antigonus Cyclops sometimes, because he was one-eyed. Now, that wasn't a peculiar thing in those days. As wounded as you got in hand-to-hand combat, there were a lot of these guys that weren't very pretty. In fact, Philip of Macedon, Alexander's dad, was one-eyed because he'd been wounded in battle. I've been to his tomb in Vergina in northern Greece, and you could even tell by his skull that he'd taken a wound across his eye. The other ones aren't particularly important for us in our between the Testament studies, except for Ptolemy and Seleucus. They're also men that aren't very humble, kind of like Alexander. Seleucus calls himself Nikator, which in Greek means the conqueror. Some of you may have tennis shoes that are called Nike. You know what Nike means in Greek? The means to conquer. So, boy, that's pretty high praise for a set of tennis shoes, isn't it? But here, Nikator is what Seleucus calls himself. And he will lose most of the Indian provinces to the east, but establish himself finally at Antioch, a city that's going to be very important in the New Testament. Ptolemy is also very important because he doesn't want to fight over the whole empire like the rest of them were doing. He just wants Egypt. He can remember those nice, sunny times that they had down in Egypt when you were with a very peaceful people that looked upon their kings as gods. And he decides that's what he'll do. I'll just take Egypt. Y'all can fight over the rest of it. One of the things he does about that, though, is he hijacks the body of Alexander that's being transported back to Macedon. They brought in Egyptian mummifiers to be able to mummify his body and take it all the way back to Macedon. Ptolemy in Mesopotamia takes the body and brings it on down to Egypt and eventually builds a tomb for it at Alexandria. And that becomes one of the most important sites in Alexandria for several centuries. In fact, for when Augustus, the Roman emperor, comes to Alexandria, he wants to look at the body of Alexander. And the legend is he looked at it and it looked like he had just fallen asleep. So the mummifiers must have done a pretty good job. One other varying tradition says that Augustus, when he looked at it, accidentally knocked his mummified nose off. But I prefer that he looked like he was just asleep. Ptolemy then rules in Egypt, and his family rules there until the time basically of the New Testament. And a little bit before the New Testament begins, the last Ptolemy, who is named, she's a female. Can you think of her name? Cleopatra is the last of the Ptolemies that rule in Egypt. So I want you to understand, here you have, for our purposes, basically an Asian empire and an Egyptian empire that are going to fight over Palestine for the next several hundred years. And they are ruled not by Asians and not by Egyptians, but they're ruled by Greeks. So this is a Greek elite, a Macedonian elite, that is in control of these two important kingdoms for a long time. They speak Greek. Their culture is Greek, although they're ruling over other people that are not Greek. And that changes Greek culture to where it's not just called Greek, it's called Hellenistic. And any time that you have a language, for example, changing where you have a majority of the people that speak it are not native speakers, it changes the language. It simplifies the language. And the language that we see the New Testament written in is not classical Greek. It's Koine Greek, common Greek, Hellenistic Greek. We see the culture changing in so many ways among them. The Greek culture becomes prominent. And as we'll talk about in just a minute, it takes it competes very highly with the Jewish culture that's spreading throughout the known world. Ptolemy calls himself Soter, which means savior. So again, we're talking about people who aren't very humble and aren't very godly. But they are people who their basic religion is a Greek religion, and their culture is Greek, that they have an emphasis in spreading throughout all of the world that they think of as the known world, the oikoumene. The diaspora, I want to talk about that for just a minute, is the dispersion among the Jews. Somebody read for me the 7th chapter of John, verse 15. John 7:15.
John 7:15.
Yes.
The Jews therefore marveled, saying, "How is it that this man is learning when he has never studied?"
35. I'm sorry. I saw the wrong thing. Verse 35.
All right, verse 35. The Jews said to one another, "Where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks?"
See, here they talk about the diaspora, the dispersion among the Greeks. Thank you, Mary. I appreciate you finding that for me. At the time that this is, that Alexander's empire has reached its largest extent, at the time that basically the period of the Middle East is divided between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, we see a lot of people among the Jews not going back to Palestine. In fact, it's thought that there may be 3 to 5 million Jews outside of Palestine at this particular time. Some have stayed in Babylon and Assyria area because they don't really have an affinity with Palestine anymore. Some people like the idea of becoming entrepreneurs and rich in some of the financial centers of the world instead of becoming pioneers in the rubble of Judea. And as the Greek world expands, you begin to have a lot of these people who have adopted the Greek language, who are Jewish, beginning to go to areas where those have been established. And for the most part, we see, especially at the beginning of this period, Jews being welcomed in cities like Alexandria and Antioch, beginning to be colonized in areas like Ephesus and Smyrna and Sardis, even Jews in Corinth and other places throughout the world that are Greek-speaking, Greek-cultured places. But yet they are situations in which they're far from the Jewish homeland. This diaspora, this dispersion, is something that in Jesus' day they knew. And this is the beginning of it here in the days of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. One thing, though, I do want to emphasize to you, though, is the fact that Greek culture and Jewish culture in the diaspora are at loggerheads with one another. We'll talk more about that next week, Lord willing. But it is important to understand that while there is much admirable about Greek culture, it is diametrically opposed to the religion that we have in the Old Testament and one that is carried on by the Jews. So this is going to provide a situation in which Jews are going to be either combining with Greek culture or reacting against Greek culture. And that's going to, in many ways, set the stage for the divisions among the Jews that we'll read about in the New Testament. Thank you very much.